First of all, if you want to go to the toilet, go out down the corridor, down the stairs, take a left through the blue doors, and there's a sign, we'll see it. The second thing is, in the event of a fire, I apologise for everyone's heard this four times before. In the event of a fire, we will leave the building in good order, and we'll go down the fire escape when we come in, out through the front entrance you just came in, across the street into this private space over there, just across the road, so that's where we'll assemble if there's a fire. I don't think there's anything else I'd say. First of all, thanks for coming tonight. We've got three sort of talks, though mine's split between two people, so we're going to try and get through them quite quickly. So we will have a break after each one, but quite short, so you know, we'll try and push it on, because we don't want to keep everybody here too long, and we'll get some discussion. I've been introducing people all week, so I'm just going to do a quick introduction about myself. I was involved in the Packersfield campaign, not right from the start, but I kind of got involved after a year or two. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what the importance of Packersfield was, and some very strange coincidences that seemed to happen at the time that I got involved in the campaign, when I was reading about the history of common land and enclosure. That's what my talk's been about. And then after that, Kev's going to do more focused talk on Packersfield and its importance and what's happened very recently. So I'll try and get on with it. How did I get involved in Packersfield? Well, the main reason I got involved in Packersfield campaign was because I'm a member of a sports club in Easton called Easton Cowboys. And we trained for free under our own control on Packersfield for many years, I think 7 years, before the development actually got exposed to us, like by some people in Whitehall, some of whom will probably be here later. So there was a kind of local campaign around the Packersfield issue whilst we were still training on the pitch, and that's how we kind of got to know about it. So kind of that's my connection. It's not some sort of like vague political thing that I thought was a good idea. It was something directly impacted on me and where I live. So, and that certainly affected a lot of the other footballers, cricketers, women's footballers in our club. So our club got involved in that campaign precisely because it affected us, but also because we have certain ideas within our sports clubs about space and about how it should be used. So, okay, just going to hold two things up, because before you do a history talk, you're meant to kind of say where your sources come from. So, this is one of my sources. It's called Albion's Fatal Tree, which is a kind of collection of essays about enclosure and other things like smuggling and hanging in London. But there's a couple of articles in here, a couple of essays in this book, which were really illuminating to me when I was reading it, certainly in my involvement in Packersfield, strangely. So I definitely recommend this book. It's not actually in print, but you can get it on Amazon. So I would definitely recommend looking at this book. The second book that's important is called Caliban and the Witch, which is on the bookstore, which talks about enclosure and peasant struggles in the 16th and 17th centuries. It's actually about witchcraft, but it kind of talks about the conditions of the peasantry in Europe and in the UK in that period, and about enclosure. So it's on the bookstore. Again, I totally recommend it. Silvia Federici was here last year speaking, and she wrote that book. And again, I was reading that around the same time. And the third thing is this my attempt at an essay, which I've not written an essay for about 20 years. So it's on the bookstore, and this is basically the content, or most of the content of what I'm going to speak about. So if you fancy getting hold of this, then I'd be very happy to see that. Okay, the title of my talk's Packersfield Reminds Me of Another Time and Another Place, which, if anybody's into punk rock, will know that's a lyric from Stiff Little Fingers, Inflammable Material. And it certainly did, when I, you know, my involvement in the campaign, and then what I was reading kind of connected so directly. I remember sitting in bed with my girlfriend going, you know, boring her to death reading this book, going, I can't believe this. Like, these things are very, very similar, and this is from like 1755. So that's where I started on this way of thinking about what's going on in Packersfield. I'm just going to give a little, very, very short kind of rundown of what happened, and I know Kev's going to talk about this in more detail. But basically, Packersfield was an area of land that was owned by the Packers, or by what it's known as Packers, is Packer owned the chocolate factory in Easton. So if you know the chocolate factory, it was kind of the playing fields for the workers of, who worked in the chocolate factory. But it was also used by a lot of people in Easton. And this piece of land, it's kind of 7 acres. If you don't know where it is, it's kind of bounded by Whitehall, Greenbank and Easton, right by the Bristol to Bath cycle track. And its importance historically is that obviously it was a green space in an area that was been massively industrialised, or massive influx of population at the end of the 19th century. If you look at any old maps of Easton, it's quite incredible to look. There's a 1905 map you can get of Easton, and you can kind of see what happened and how rapidly it happened. The industrialisation was obviously mining and tanneries and a huge influx of urban workers into Easton. And this was one of the areas that was kind of protected from that process, mainly because it was owned by the chocolate factory and it was used for recreation, like sporting activities, picnics. So it's a fairly rare piece of open space in Easton, if you actually know Easton quite well. It stayed protected for a long time. Eventually, I think in the 1930s, the Packers chocolate factory got into trouble and talked about selling it. It came partly under the jurisdiction of St. George's School at the time. So it was kind of used by the school, used by the community. In the last 30 years at least, maybe 40 years, certainly the older people in Whitehall will talk about this. It was seen as basically a place where you could go. You know, you could use it, you could walk around, you could play football on it. Kids used it. It was kind of a space treated like common land. In fact, this is a really important concept, is that people treated it as their space. Okay? And you might dismiss that, because obviously there's not much relation to property right. But in real life, in the history of England, most common spaces and the way they've been approached by people is to do with how they used them and how long they've used them. And often they were used for so long that no one could remember, you know, whether there was any kind of property ownership, and there probably wasn't. Often people would talk about royal charters to protect common land, but a lot of this stuff was often the way people kind of tried to justify their usage of the land when there was some kind of enclosure. But actually, what really defines common land is the way that people use it, and the way that people understand it, and the customary rights that they develop within the communities that use that land. Okay, this is a very important concept, but I'll come on to it in a minute. So if you want to go on to the next one, Rich. Okay, this is a statement by a South London Radical History Group, who've done a lot of work on parks in South London. And through their research, they produced a book which is actually called Down With The Fences, where you can see where we nicked the title for these events from. But this is a quote which I really like, because it's not the way that I ever understood parks, or I was brought up to understand. I hope you can see it, but so most of the open spaces, commons, woods, greens that exist in our cities remain today because they were preserved from development by collective action, whether by rioting, tearing down fences and reopening enclosed land, or by legal agitation. Many of the commons and parks that we know and love would have been lost if they hadn't been actively defended. And they've done a lot of work on South London spaces, commons, greens and parks, and that's where they got the statement from. It's an important thing to think about, because I've always been told, well, certainly when I was growing up, that parks were this kind of holy area that was protected by the Victorians, and it was kind of part of the state and protection. But that kind of a lot of time came afterwards, after this threat to those spaces had been kind of averted by people who lived in those areas. Okay, quick structure of my talk. So a little bit about the commons, mentioned a little bit about right, a little bit about customary right, and then I'm going to talk about the enclosures, the people who want to enclose land historically, and the tactics and propaganda they've used both in the past and now. A little bit about legal precedent. I'm not going to go into any legal jargon, because there's, I don't know, the barrister's not here in a minute and I'll probably get it wrong. So, finally, a bit of discussion about privatisation as a concept of progress, which we keep being thrown at us at the moment. Mm-hmm. And finally, a little conclusion. So, okay, what are the commons? I'm sure a lot of you know this if you're historians or you study those periods, but basically they provided a lot of things for people in communities. In fact, they supported large numbers of people, certainly grazing and food. I mean, there was a study done, I think, in the 18th century, which said that for a lot of poor people, 50% of their food, their resources, the things they needed to live were actually coming from common land, and that's a very important thing. It wasn't like, oh, I've just lost my playing field, I can't play football anymore. It was like, I'm on the road, I'm a vagabond now, because if I can't use this land, if I can't use the grazing rights, if I can't use the right to gather firewood, which is often their only source of energy, if I can't gather food, if I can't use these spaces, then it really did push people from poor lifestyles into desperate lifestyles. Okay, so it's very important. The commons are important historically for that. Fuel and materials, obviously, they're also very important in the communities because they provided festivals, games and gathering spaces. So football, for example, was often played on common land, eventually cricket, but other games were played. I think proper village football was played on commons. And also some other aspects, more social aspects, that because they had to be kind of these customary rights that people actually, I mean, common land is not just this free-for-all, it's sometimes how it's presented these days. Common land involved all sorts of fairly complex and sometimes simple rules about how that land would be used. So we understand here the land is not owned, it's how it's used that's important. And people come up with rules in communities, they kind of work it out. They come up with ways of operating which sustain those spaces and also ways that protect them as well from encroaching. So collective decision-making and work cooperation was actually quite important in common land. Although it's not something that appears in the statute book, although there's some kind of memories in the legal statute book in the state, most of it, the vast majority of it was organised by people who actually lived there and they came up with their rules. So to give you an example, I was chatting to a guy who was speaking on Saturday, Steve Mills, who's going to be doing a talk on one-day houses, which is where you can whack a house up on common land. As long as you can get the house up by the next morning and get a fire going in the chimney, you can live there. And he said, I was always confused about how they actually worked out, you know, where you could gather firewood from and what was your kind of neighbourhood if you put up a one-day house on common land. And he said, people came up with a basic strategy, and what you did was you stood at the door of your house and you picked up an axe and you threw it as far as you could, and that kind of defined your local wood-gathering area. So, they came up with all sorts of ways of doing this. So there's a lot to this, and I'm not going to go into the details, but trust me, there's a level of complexity around common land derived from the people who lived there. And finally, they served an important social function for women historically, and the reason was is that as you go into the 16th, 17th century, and also earlier as well, you find that women don't have much access to their means of reproduction, food and other things. So common land actually allowed large numbers of women to have some kind of freedom. They didn't have to be tied into marriage, for example. To give you an idea, in Germany, I think in the 16th century, more than 60% of the population wasn't married. So there were a lot of women out there who lived off common land. It's important. So it served a social function in that sense. Okay, what's customary right? I mean, I've kind of mentioned a bit about customary right, but basically customary rights are these kind of fairly simple or complex rules for administering the land on behalf of the community. Okay, but they're different because they're not about, there's a difference between somebody owning something and using the law to kind of administer it. This is quite different. This is a community that comes up with its rules for running that space. And so basically the first important thing about customary rights derived often from the people at the base, the people who are actually using it. I did a talk about Moby Dick last year, and Herbert Melville talks about this, and he says, there's these very simple rules of the sea. So they weren't just confined to the land, there'd be rules of the sea commons as well. So they follow similar patterns, derived by the people who use it or work it. Okay. And these rules are kind of self-managed. When I say mediated, what I mean by that is there's not like some lawyer stepping in and saying, well, actually the rules are these, or the state stepping in to mediate disputes. These disputes, if there were disputes, which they were dealt with by the community. They weren't mediated by some external power. Okay, so self-managed and non-mediated is what customary rights are about. There was a belief in charter and bequest, and this is important because that belief in charter often. Royal, the crown, and I think Steve Paul again is speaking about the relationship between the crown and the people around these issues on Saturday, but I won't go into detail, and I couldn't, but often there were charters granted. Back in the, I think the one, for example, for Brandon Hill in Bristol was somewhere back in the, someone correct me, back in the 14th century, where you can go out and put your washing up there and things. If you want to dry your washing, go up Brandon Hill and hang it up. No one can do anything about it. So there were kind of charters granted, but that was a charters were often granted because of struggles between the crown and the people. So there were kind of deals that were done, somewhat like the Magna Carta as well. And bequeath or bequeathing land as well. I mean, for example, on Packers Field, a lot of the older people in the community said, "Oh well, yeah, when Cole, who was the eventual owner of the chocolate factory, gave Packers Field to the community, he bequeathed it to us. He said, this is for, I think, for the eternal good of Easton." So people talked about that. But you usually find these ideas about bequeathing and charter appearing when there's a threat. Okay, when there's a threat to land, people start trying to come up with reasons to oppose the state or the property owners who are trying to enclose the land. Okay, so I wouldn't argue that that's why we've got common land, because we've got charters. Charters appear, or the use of charters to try and protect it, is related to a threat to it. People are trying to find justification for hanging on to it against maybe a state incursion. I was going to say a little bit about legal property rights. Obviously, there's some very different things about how legal property rights work for private ownership and common land. I mean, the obvious ones are that common land isn't technically owned by anybody. You can't sell common land. Okay, that was the way it originally worked. Anyway, you can't just decide, "Oh, I can sell that." So you might be you might have some status within the community. You might be, some fairly well-to-do person, might be a politician, but you can't just decide to sell something. Okay, it's definitely held within those communities' power what they did with it. And legal property rights are quite different. Obviously, once you've got ownership, you've got the deeds, and you define the space. Which is another thing, a lot of these struggles around common land, the biggest problem that the commoners had was that they couldn't actually define what the common land was, because they didn't actually have a boundary to it. Often it wasn't clear where the common land was. So in the 18th century, for example, lawyers would run in and say, we want to try and buy this bit. And people would say, well, which bit? And then they'd try and mark it on a map and no one would really know. And often that was also used to try and defeat people in courts as well. And it was used directly to stop the town green application, which I'll talk about in a minute, on Packers Field succeeding. So there's been a long history of this idea of not being able to define lands. And as a consequence, that's led to legal defeats. And I'll come on to that in a minute. And finally, the town green 20-year rule is very interesting. This is a kind of memory of this kind of usage, the idea that people used it for a long time. It's customary right, it's what we do by custom. So the town green application, which was where Packers Field campaign and members of the Whitehall Community, Eastern and Green Bank, tried to take control of Packers Field to stop it being sold off by the council. Okay, and the way they did that was to apply this bit of law from the 1960s, I think it is, which was aimed at protecting land which wasn't a park. Okay, which wasn't a park or a protected space. And the 20-year rule basically says is, if you can show that for at least 20 years people have used this space, they've not been stopped from using it, and they've not been informed that they can't use it, then technically it's a town green, and that means it's common land and it's something that we can all use. Okay, right. When I was reading these books, I was reading away, and I was kind of reading about what I thought, this would be interesting. What did they actually say? When these enclosures came along, when the state intervened, what were they saying about the people that were using common land? Okay, and I was struck, and you'll see in a minute why I was struck by this. But these are the kind of descriptions they used. Okay, so they defined. And I'll show you some quotes in a minute. But basically, these are the descriptions of the commoners that were used to try and get control of the commons as private property. Okay, so the people who wanted it had to kind of portray the commons as places where thieves and vagabonds hung out. There is a massive irony in that. There's a massive irony in defining people who use common land as vagabonds, because actually, when you take the common land away, you create vagabonds. Okay, so it's kind of a strange thing to say, but that's what they said. There's vagabonds living out there. And they took the common land away, and they had 10 times as many vagabonds. So
They also said that they're obsessed with this idea that the commoners are kind of animals, subhumans, beasts. They're like, you know, they're not really human, okay? Bear that in mind in a minute as well. They were places of disorder and lawlessness, you know. There's no concept, I mean, obviously I'm sure they knew, but there was no concept amongst the enclosers that people would actually create things like customary right. They knew that, but they weren't going to talk about it. They had to portray these places as just crazy places where anything happened, you know, rape, murder, terrible places. Bear that in mind as well. And they also, this is the most insidious one, and the most related to, I would say, British colonial history, but also British history within the UK, or the history of enclosure. And that's the idea that these people were lazy and idle. So I'm sure you've heard of, like, lazy people from the Caribbean, okay? Lazy people from the colonies in India, people sitting around doing nothing. Well, that's the way the British Empire portrayed people who didn't want to work down its mines, didn't want to work in its factories, didn't want to be forced into wage labour. That's the words they used. And this happened a bit after this in the colonial expansion, obviously, in the 18th and 19th centuries, but in the 20th, but 18th, but that idea comes directly from the struggles around common land, okay? And we'll see why that is in a minute. And finally, these people are backward. You know, the enclosures were progressive. We were creating this new world of manufacturing and kind of rationalised agriculture. And so they were progressive. And again, bear that in mind. So a few quotes here. These are actual quotes now. If you want to know all the references, they're all referenced in the essay. So I haven't put them all on there. You just have to trust me that they're real. But okay, so the nurseries, this is what they said. This is what the enclosers said. This is what the propagandists of the enclosers said. Nurseries and receptacles of thieves, rogues and beggars. There was laziness and disorder. About the Forest of Dean, people are very... the Forest of Dean, and we were out on Monday. Apparently, these people are very lewd lives and conversations, leaving their own in other countries and taking them... So they're foreigners. Probably from Wales or something, you know. Taking the place for shelter as a cloak to their villainies. Okay. Yeah. So that's the Forest of Dean.
Sometimes right.
Well, yeah, I'm not arguing about that, but we'll see whether they're right. We'll see whether they're right in a minute, because this is the good point. I mean, it's how the whole of those commoners were portrayed, and that's really important. I don't deny there were probably thieves and vagabonds in those areas. You know, I've got a problem with vagabonds myself, but you know. But we'll see about this in a minute. It's a good point, actually. The poor of Northamptonshire dwell in woods and deserts and live like drones, devoted to thievery, among whom are bred the very spawn of vagabonds and rogues. Next. More of this as goes on. Okay, a bit of beast stuff now. Okay, so this is a description from 1755, I remember this one, from Cannock Chase, okay? That desperate character, a poacher, he who sleeps by day and prowls for food at night, soon acquires the disposition of a savage or wild beast, a disposition which must lead to robbery and every species of a nocturnal depredation. Okay, you know. Well, just a quick thing, poaching, right? Poaching, we understand what the word poacher means, right? In 1755, they were just learning what poaching was. Because as far as the commoners were concerned, you could go on the common land and, you know, kill a rabbit. You know, I don't know, cut a duck's throat and have it for breakfast or something. You know, that was normal. No one could own animals. That's ridiculous. Owning animals is insane. I mean, how do you own a bird? Can you own a bird? That's what they thought. You know, this is what commoners thought. And they were quite right, actually, I believe. But of course, when you get enclosure, people start saying, well, hang on a minute, I own all the rabbits on my piece of enclosed common land, and you can't come in here and eat them anymore. And people really didn't understand that. They were like, kind of, okay, I can see what a fence is, but I don't really understand how you can own a rabbit, you know, that runs around, that's wild. Really important. So the poacher, the word poaching appears at that point. It's a criminal thing. It becomes criminalised. And people really don't understand why they're being criminalised. Okay, it's very important. So, and of course, the poacher then has to become a beast or a subhuman or whatever. You know, it's the propaganda expands. So long as they may be permitted to live in such idleness upon their stock of cattle, they will bend themselves to no labour. Sorry, what that means is they won't work for you. Okay. common of pasture is a maintaining of the idlers and beggary of the cottagers. So, okay, these people are outside the wage labour system, okay, pretty much. That's not really what the manufacturers want, and it's certainly not what the agricultural enclosers want. So they have to portray these people as idle and lazy and, you know, get them working for them. And the best way of doing that is to take their subsistence away from them. Okay. Lazying upon a common to attend one cow and a few sheep. Sounds great to me, personally. Rather than working down somebody's mine or in somebody's factory for 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. So. Anyway, moving on. In unenclosed villages, children are nursed up in idleness and become indisposed for labour. Then begging is their portion or thieving is their trade. Okay. So again, this came in, I think, the talk last year about wrecking, where there was a real fear that because these communities have been there a long time, they're bringing their children up in the same way of life. Like, you know what? Stay out of the factory. It's much better here. Enclosure will give the poor an interest in toiling whom terror never could endure to travail. So what that's saying is like, you know, the best way of sorting this out, we could try terror, okay? So these are terrorists. These are terrorists. They're saying, well, you know, we got taxes here. We need to get them off this land. We need to get them into the work. So we can either terrorise them, but we don't think that works. The best way is just to take their subsistence away from them. And finally, coming on to dogs in a minute, vermin and dogs. That's what they call them. Okay, so what does this all mean? What did this mean in practice in that period? Well, it was kind of an unholy alliance between the landowners who had a kind of interest in rationalising and expanding their landowners into common land. And of course they used criminality as their basis for doing that. You know, if we get rid of this common land, then everything will be much better, there'll be much better security. Of course, I'm sure they were great social reformers and they really wanted to do that. But I believe their primary aim is to take the land. And I would put the word developer in there, because this is the kind of language that was used in some of it's certainly been used in Bristol to define to support the taking of playing fields, for example. And the manufacturer had an interest as well, because, you know, needed labour, and all these people living on this common land not working for them is a bit of a problem. So they used idleness, that was their thing. Idleness is a sin, you know, kind of Protestant thing, you know. And they wanted to get control over that labour. And the best way of doing that is, again, take subsistence away. And again, I would put the word commercialisation there. We'll have a little chat about that in a minute. Next. Okay, Packersfield 2005. What's the connection? It's a long jump in history. You know, we jumped about 300 or 400 years there. This is what they said. Okay, this is from a county council document. And it was put together with comments from people from the Academy School. And also a large number of, a significant number of letters which were written in. Mostly, I would say probably 90% of them were from outside of Whitehall, Eastern or Greenbank. Okay, there were letters from West Beyond Trim and I think there was one from Canesham. I mean, I read through all the letters that were put in. It's in a document, you can get hold of it. And this is basically how they portrayed the users of Packers Field. Okay, these are the categories. So we've got vandals, joyriders and arsonists, okay. Thieves and muggers, drug dealers and drug abusers, suspected paedophiles. I mean, they were obviously pushing themselves a bit here to work on this one. And finally, the most cruel and vicious of all, the dog walkers. Okay, this was mentioned. You know, now, obviously, as far as I'm aware, there were some dog walkers there when I played football and went down there. But I didn't really see any of the rest of this. Now, you know, maybe there was the odd car burned out in Easton. I believe there was about 20 a month at that stage when this was done, but not on Packers Field. Anyway, this is the way they portrayed us. Okay, they didn't just portray the users in the council documents like this. They also launched a kind of propaganda campaign in the newspapers. Right? Now, there's just one point about this. When they decided to go down this route, which involved also, which I'm sure Kevin mentioned, getting school children to write letters to the council, they kind of got the whole classes to do it, to support their taking of the land at the Academy School. And, but the kind of strange thing about this is how divisive this is. Yeah. I mean, it's to go down this path of propaganda is kind of very divisive within the community. Okay, because you're basically portraying more than 95%, I don't know the figure, of the people who use it as this. Okay. And that's not a popular thing to do in a community, I would argue, especially if you're the principal of an academy school, where your pupils are these people. Okay? Their pupils were these people. They used it, so they must be this. And I don't think anybody in an academy school would be very happy about the fact, well, maybe dog walkers, but you wouldn't be happy if your kids were these things.
That's why they need education, you see, to reform them.
Make reform them, yeah.
Presumably the people's parents as well.
Oh yeah, it's everybody, not much distinction made about it.
Getting their kids to say their mum and dad were all those things.
Well, yeah, I don't think the parents really. My mum goes down to Hackersfield, I denounced her. Well, you'd be surprised, there was a big stuff. Anyway, next, do you want to show next one? So, I've got a couple of articles here. There was actually quite a few. I've chosen a couple here, a few examples, but this is the Evening Post. So, the interesting thing about these articles, they're not like field used by dealers and gangs, what are we going to do about it? It's. Being used by dealers and gangs, and there's kind of this dispute about property over it going on, so that appears in these articles, so they're kind of connected. So dealers and gangs are connected with people who want to try and, keep it as common land. Children playing a toilet for dogs, it says here, a playing field at the centre of a row over planning is a toilet for dogs. So it's like, to be fair to the Evening Post, this is how it started, and then they realised that obviously people in the community weren't very pleased about this, and they were actually doing something that was quite positive, so they kind of put some articles in the other way. But this is how it started, and there was a significant number of these. I can name about six or seven if you go and look in the Evening Post. Right, next. Okay, just want to talk very briefly. So that's a connection about the way the propaganda was done. You can see the relationship there. Okay, legal precedent. In this book, Albion's Fatal Tree, there's a really, really great essay on a place called Cannock Chase, which is near Birmingham. A big struggle in the 18th century to retain its common land as a single landowner tried to take the whole lot. It's a big place. This landowner, I've forgotten his name now, should be able to remember it, his historian or whatever. But he already owned land in six other counties. It was huge, and he was trying to take Cannock Chase. So it's a really good essay to read because it kind of gives you an idea of a kind of anatomy of a struggle in the 18th century to retain access to that land. So and why it was important was I was kind of reading about it, and of course the commoners of Cannock Chase, who were miners, all sorts of people who used the land, they kind of did follow the legal path. They tried to protect it. They thought, well, we'll follow the legal path first. They started with that. Peaceful, legal path. Difficult thing to do in the 18th century, and the law was somewhat corrupt, I would argue. And it's certainly extremely difficult to get a result if you were from the lower classes. Okay. So what they did first was they said, well, we've got customary right over Cannock Chase. Okay, we've got customary right. We've got this charter from the 13th century or something, and there was a manorial charter from 1595 as well. But the problem was they couldn't actually find it. And I said, commoners tend to resort to these things when they're having to enter the legal process, just as the Packersfield people did. Okay, it was very similar. I mean, the Packersfield campaign was looking for, when all these old people talked about bequeathing of land, they were looking for a document that Cole, who ran the chocolate factory, may have written, saying, here's the land, okay? Couldn't find it. And more interestingly, the council documents, where they took access to the land off Cole, or took a level of legal control over the land, they were missing as well. So kind of all the stuff was missing, and that was a problem for the commoners. And it was also a problem for Cannock Chase. They had the same problem. They couldn't find the documents. And of course, there's these people sitting there with deeds, written up deeds, saying, well, I own this. And where's your document? You haven't got one. And the commoners go, no, but this goes back to, hundreds of years ago. And they go, well, yeah, whatever. Sorry, meaningless. You've got nothing. So that's a problem with common land. It's like, actually, if you're going to fight in a legal battle, you're up against it. And you've got to have the documents to protect yourself. And most of the time, they don't exist. Or they're maybe not as clear as they should be. Certainly, both of those things happen. The definition of locality was the most amazing coincidence. In the Town Green application, which was a week-long inquiry, the main reason we lost as a campaigning group and as a community was because part of the Town Green application involves there's a definition of locality. Now, you can see where it comes from, because this was written in the 60s. There was all this green belt expansion going on. There's all these villages and stuff. And, you know, what they're worried about is village greens disappearing. So it's very easy to define a locality around the village green. It's a village. Okay, but when you're in a city, it's a bit more complicated. And at the time, you had to define a locality that was associated with the common land. Okay, very difficult to see, especially in Packersfield. You've got Whitehall, Greenbank and Eastern. Same thing happened in Cannock Chase. They lost in court on the Cannock Chase fight because everybody said, well, it's kind of here, right? It's here. They kind of defined it. And then some old bloke stood up, right? It was a commoner, it was a bit off his head, apparently, and got it wrong. He said, well, you know, I don't think it's down by the old tree. I think it extends out to X, Y, and Z and that river over there. And because the commoners couldn't actually define the locality of the common in Cannock Chase in 1755, they lost. They lost the court case. And it's exactly what happened to us. Because they wanted to define a community, for example, we said, well, okay, we're forced to do this, so we'll define it as Whitehall. And then they dismissed all witnesses from Eastern and Greenbank as being irrelevant, okay, because they didn't come from the locality. So a massive similarity there between in the way the law works. And we know the lawyer who came down to fight against the Town Green application had used this three times before, this idea of locality, to defeat it. So it's a technical thing, and you know, it's a real problem. Although there has been some changes in the law recently, apparently, in the House of Lords, because they've been defeated in every city, these Town Green applications, by this tactic. Purely legal technicality, nothing to do with the usage, nothing to do with the people who are actually accessing it, anything like that. Okay, right. These are kind of things we gathered out of the things that were said about Packersfield. When I was playing football down there, before the development started, really, I was chatting to the groundsman, and he said, well, you know, he said, looked after the football pitches down, he said, mate, he said, it's going to be a nightmare. He said, this place is going to be like, you'll see fences 10 foot high, there'll be swipe cards and cameras. That's what they want. That's how they're going to deal with this. This will be properly enclosed, you know, 21st century enclosed. Cameras, swipe cards and fences. Okay. And the way this was presented at the time was that this would improve security. Okay. Well, yeah, it probably would. If you were living there. Right? You know, I'm sure you wouldn't get any mates around, you know, whatever. But the point was is that security, you know, security is an interesting definition. So you can see here, privatisation, this is the way they present it. Fences, CCTV cameras, swipe cards, commercialisation of space equals security, safety and progress. Okay, but the problem is where do the kids play? You know, the kids who used it and the people who used it, yeah, we've been excluded. I mean, if you take everybody away and put a fence around something, yeah, I'm sure the security will improve. But what happens in the rest of Eastern or Whitehall or Greenbank when no one's got to play anywhere? Security's bound to fall, get worse. So this argument, you'll see it continually used over, and you'll see it in developments that are occurring now. You'll hear it about Stokes Croft, you'll hear it everywhere. It's used. Very powerful thing in this time of fear of crime, okay, to use this argument. Second thing, free space as a kind of juxtaposition. Free space equals disorder, backwardness, rubbish, dog shit, drugs, violence, and sex crime, apparently. So, you know, this is the other side of the coin that they were presenting. So that's, again, you'll see this repeated. Just a few quotes here, you know, which came up, which kind of reflect this. There's a lot more than, you know, I've just picked a few. But okay, this is the principle of the Academy speaking. Should the Town Green application become successful, i.e. the community has some access to the site, there will be no security on the site. Okay, which I mean, I find that insulting myself. You know, I find that as insulting as somebody uses it. You know, like you know, if we're actually allowed to go on it, there'll be disorder and crime, and it'll be terrible. There's no security for anybody. So that was one way. Another person said from the Academy that it would be a free for all. I never quite understood what that meant. Actually, I was like, oh, it could sound all right. You know, it might be quite a good laugh. Maybe I could just go and play football, and that might be a free for all football. I don't know. And this last one was, I think, an absolute classic in the inquiry. We were talking to the local councillors, you know. So on here you see it says, you know, somebody was chatting to a local councillor at the public inquiry, said, well, you know, when you see a hole in a fence and a green space beyond, what do you think? You know, what does that mean to you as a councillor? And they said, well, I think it's vandalism. You know, do you remember being 12? You know, do you know why there's a hole in the fence? Like, no concept. Which is really worrying, because these people, you know, are actually supposedly managing our environments and managing crime. You know, if you've got no kids that know we've got nowhere to play, you know, you've got a problem, haven't you? You know, it's all very 1930s to be kicking a ball about on the street, but you know, it's not really ideal, is it? Yeah. Okay, so just some conclusion. I'm going to finish there. There's a couple more slides after this, some pictures, but okay. So I've kind of covered a few things here. Ideas of ownership, private ownership of common land. The kind of contradiction between the usage, and we're going to talk about this quite a lot tonight, about usage of buildings, usage of spaces, okay? Because that's really important. That's where we come in, the public. Okay? We don't have control over them as such, but we certainly use them. And that's a really important concept. It doesn't fit in with legal property rights, in my opinion. Okay? It's a place of contestation. What we want as users and what somebody who owns it wants for that place, and that's a problem. Okay, the moment it goes into private ownership, you're going to get that battle. It's not technically under our control anymore. It's a battle. And we don't have any legal standing on that. So it's pressure. It's public pressure, popular democracy that will enforce social use on places. Okay. I've talked about the legal definition of locality and the ideas of, like, you know, how that's been used legally to defeat attempts to try and get public space or control public space in the community. I've talked about the representation of the common owner. You've seen, you know, what they said and what they said in the 16th, 17th century. And also these ideas about progress, efficiency and security, which are the kind of buzzwords of neoliberal ideas about privatisation. And finally, a really important thing, and, you know, and one of the criticisms which I think, you know, you kind of made really, which is that, you know, what actually makes common land? You know, common land doesn't become a good place because it's a piece of land. Common land becomes a good place because you have a community that is not only like respecting it and being responsible for it, but also putting together ways of using it and ways of administering it as well. And that's really important, because in this world, I would argue that communities are breaking down. I think we live in a very atomised world, you know, and that's when I say atomised, I mean a world where we don't actually know who our neighbours are, we don't actually know many people in our communities, and there are many divisions. And that's good and bad, in different degrees of that, I would argue, in Bristol. So a community is what's vital in running and keeping these spaces open. And it is not an argument, I would argue, for people like neoliberals and property developers to talk about, you know, about these things, to talk about common land and say that basically what they're saying is our communities are shit. We cannot organise. We're not responsible. You know, we're not capable of running our areas. And in some cases, they're right. Okay? But that's not an argument for taking away what's left of what we control and what we use and giving us less control. That's not the argument. But they use that all the time. So the effect on the community is really important. What I mean by that is when you enclose spaces, when you lose access to them, it will impact on the community. It will impact on the community. The landowner might not see it behind his CCTV cameras and his fences. He may not see it. And he's driving around in his nice car and clearing off, and then probably living there anyway. We have to deal with it where we live. So community is really important on that level, and there's a lot of issues around that. But it's not an argument I would accept from neoliberals. Their society is in problem. They've got problems. Okay, there's problems in this society and they're not all of our making, let's put it that way. Right, just a couple of little pictures to finish. There's a great ballad from 1607, I thought it's quality. It's a ballad anyway, so it's come from the people probably. There may be rich men, both yeomen and gentry, that for their own private gain hurt a whole country. By closing free commons, yet they'll make as though 'twere for the common good. But I know what I know. And I know what I know, because I live in a community and I know how we use that space. So, something to remember. The last thing is this picture, which is a picture of a Packersfield Bun Day. And I kind of sums up this argument about, you know, community under construction. Because there does need to be some construction going on in our societies if we want security, and if we want some freedoms, and if we want a better life. And that's it.